there, it's Ziva, and welcome to On Becoming, the podcast that explores and unpacks the winding paths we take to become who we are. For the first episode of Season 2, I am thrilled to introduce you to the gender equality author and activist, Clara Moly. Clara is French and is one of my dear early clients. We worked together in 2019, and she was actually in my office the day of the Notre Dame fire. But that's a little aside. Clara reached out to me after returning back home to Paris after 5 years working abroad in Brazil as a commodities trader, which means she bought and sold commodities like wheat, cocoa, and that sort of stuff on the market. As the only woman in her field, the experience exposed huge gender inequalities in the workplace. She came back from the experience clear on what she no longer wanted professionally, but in a total fog about what she did want. And that's a lot of what our work was about, helping her feel her way forward even though she was lacking the obvious "this is the right move" signals that made her decisions earlier so clear. A few months into our coaching, Clara decided to channel her learnings working in the all-male environment of finance into a podcast series called Les Règles du Jeu, or The Rules of the Game, which offered concrete steps to empower women every day at work. The success of that series led to the publication of her book by the same name in 2020. Since then, Clara has been guest lecturing and teaching about gender equality while also leaning more heavily into financial literacy for women. Last year, she created a new podcast series called The Starter Pack, a 6-episode series designed to open the door of the world of investment to women who find the field intimidating, elusive, and out of reach. In this conversation, we talk about where her passion for women's advocacy comes from, what she learned about self-preservation and self-value working in an all-male field, how she learned to shed the good girl syndrome and start advocating for herself, and why her work around financial literacy is actually somewhat of a transgressive act because it puts power in women's hands to invest in the world in the way that they envision it. Please enjoy this conversation and let me know what comes up for you. I'm dying to hear. Bye. Hello, Clara.
Hello, Ziva.
I'm so excited to have you here with me today. Thank you for agreeing to join me today and for regaling me and our listeners with your beautiful English, even though it is not your native language. And I don't know, do you do this often? Do you often do interviews in English or is this a first?
I did a few, but it's not the most common, no. I usually do interviews in French.
Okay, I know. We usually speak in French, So this is a little bit of a new thing. So on this podcast, as you know, we peel back the onion a bit and take a closer look at the path you've traveled to become the person you are while shedding light and unpacking some of those pivotal moments that really kind of crafted you into the person that you are. This particular season, I don't know if it's going to be the case for every person I speak with, but there's a sub-theme going on. I'm very interested in what happens when we take a journey somewhere that is not where we originate from, and there's some kind of eye-opening moment, a realization that occurs during that experience, and the next part of the journey becomes about how do you weave those realizations, the kind of eye-opening moments into your real world if you feel so compelled to. When I was planning the season, I thought of you immediately, as our listeners will find out more why. But before we begin, I wanted to know if there's anything about your journey that you would like to dig a little bit into that you would like to personally gain insight over.
Well, first of all, thank you for having me. I'm super happy to be doing this with you. That's a tough one. I would say no. Nothing comes to mind. So I will be just, you know, I will let myself be carried by your questions.
All right. So full terrain to explore. I wanted to give a little bit of a context about how we know each other and kind of put a little marker in the map. So you and I met back in 2018, 2019, as I was just starting my coaching practice. You were one of my first clients. Mm-hmm. And I remember you coming to me because you were at a crossroads in your life. You had recently come back from living in Brazil for several years where you were working as a trader. And you were clear that something had shifted and you wanted to make an impact.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you want to make an impact in on the world.
Mm-mm.
And you were confused and nervous and fearful that you'd never really figure out what that impact would be and how you would do it.
Mm-hmm.
So those are my recollections. What do you remember about that time and what was going on for you?
So yes, I was just coming back from 5 years living in Brazil,
mm-hmm.
which had been, you know, five super intense years because I went there right after I graduated. Being a trader was my very first job. We left with my then boyfriend, now husband, without a job, without knowing anybody in Brazil, without, you know, speaking the language or anything. I just had a very precise idea. And that's something, you know, I had felt at the time that I've been looking for since, actually. It's really a super strong drive, you know. At some point, you just feel physically that you need to take that path. It's super nice when you feel it because everything seems so easy and evident. And for me, before I left for Brazil, you know, I knew I wanted to become a commodity trader, which is super specific. Like it's really not a common job. I knew that's what I wanted to do. And I knew Brazil was a great place to do it. Brazil didn't come from, you know, nowhere. I mean, my dad lived in Brazil for a few years. I remember in my childhood, I've been, you know, emerging Brazilian music and Brazil. So I think it was in me somehow. Going to Brazil at that moment in life, it was maybe a way to reconnect with a part of my early background, early childhood memories. And so we went to Brazil, one-way ticket. I remember I had 2,000 euros on my bank account, and that was it. And we were supposed to find a job and make a living there, which is what we did for 5 years. So it was a great adventure. The job in itself, I loved, even though it came with its challenges. And those challenges I turned into something else afterwards, because obviously I was the only woman being a commodity trader in São Paulo at the time. And so it was extremely challenging, but intellectually it was super fulfilling. It was super exciting. Adrenaline every day. I mean, it was really intense. Mm-hmm. And then at some point, like 5 years later, I found myself reaching a kind of a wall or something like that. Like I couldn't find any more joy or any more enthusiasm in what I was doing. I was looking at my bosses, you know, my direct boss and his boss and I couldn't, you know, picture myself in them and in the life they had, because basically in those worlds of trading, everything revolves around making a lot of money, which is great, but it's also, for me at that point, it was not enough. And so basically I decided to quit. And at that point, my husband, who works for a French bank, was offered a job back in Paris. So we arrived in Paris and I am in a very, foggy place. I think I came to you because I was looking for that same sensation that I had felt 5 years earlier, where somehow you don't know why and you don't know how and you don't know which conversation triggered what, but you find yourself with a very strong instinct about what you should be doing with your life. Even though, you know, like from a outside or exterior point of view, it seems crazy. Like when I talked to my friends or parents about what I was willing to do with my life before going to Brazil, they thought I was completely crazy. But I was super confident in my choice. I knew.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think to move on to the next phase, I was looking for the same drive and conviction and physical sensation about what I should be doing.
Mm.
It didn't come. It didn't come. It didn't come. And so I said, okay, maybe I need help. Let's go to Ziva. And that's how we met.
Right. I remember, and it's really interesting what you're saying, is that when you have had a moment where something was so obvious and it allowed you to really tap into your courage and make some big changes, move country, really, you know, have your whole entourage being like, what the hell are you doing? Is that, are you sure? And you're like, yeah, of course I'm sure. When I think that this is something that occurs often is when you've already experienced that and then you're further down the line in your path and you're not getting the same green lights. Mm. You're not lit up. You're not clear. It's not just like, yes, this is the path. The question then becomes, how do I know again what I want to do when it's not coming to me mm-hmm. naturally? Mm-hmm. And that is a very common place that a lot of my clients arrive at, is that there had been at some point a moment in their lives where things just seemed obvious. Mm-hmm. And then those indicators fade away and they're in a place where they're trying to capture something that isn't coming to them. Mm-hmm. And so the question is, how do you still find a way forward mm-hmm. when you're not getting a full body yes, when it's yeah. not 100% clear? And it's kind of those moments I sometimes think about, like when you're in the, you're hiking and suddenly the fog comes in and you can't really see, you can't see your destination. How do you still move forward?
Yeah, I think the difficulty is when you experienced this very strong instinct once, you look for it, you know, it's addictive. You try things to try to trigger it again. Like you remember that sensation that was so thrilling. I think I've been looking or waiting for it ever since. But meanwhile, you know, life is happening. And so it doesn't mean that you don't do anything. But basically what happened more or less at the same time is that having been the only woman on my field for years, I got interested in understanding what it means to be a woman at work. Mm-hmm. And so while I was, you know, trading and living my life in Brazil, my commitment and my interest in those questions grew and grew and grew. And at some point, I realized that I had understood a few things that I felt like sharing, because talking to friends, talking to other women, you know, I realized that some of my insights could be useful to other people. And so I decided to create a podcast that was right at the moment I came back to France, called The Rules of the Game, which has mm-hmm. been translated to English. Sometimes I wake up at night and the story is here, or the what I'm supposed to say is right here. And then I enter a phase where I have to write it. And for The Rules of the Game, that was exactly how it happened. It was like, okay, this you need to say. And then the writing is a very easy phase. But it's also because it has come from a long time of maturing, you know, underwater. Like I didn't realize I was mm-hmm. maturing anything. But at some point, up, it comes to the surface. And then I have to write it down. Basically, that's what happened for The Rules of the Game. And so I wrote it and the podcast came out and it was a big success right away. And then things kind of, you know, happened. Like then a publishing house came to me asking, okay, do you want to make a book out of it? So I said, yes, obviously. And then the book, well, poor book, came out right before, came out on March 4th, 2020, if anyone remembers more or less where wow. it was at that time. But anyways, even though it was not perfect, you know, it still has its own life ever since, and I'm quite happy about it. And then basically I then followed more than I led, also because I became a mother at that time. I let myself be carried by everything that was happening in the field of equality at work, and so I, you know, I started doing, you know, conferences and talks and in companies, in schools, and I started talking about it everywhere mm-hmm. I could and everywhere I was invited to. So to get back to your question, how do you do? In my case, maybe I was lucky enough to have something to cling to, which was my commitment, which is not a detail in my life. I mean, it's super important for me, but I can't mm-hmm. say that it happened in the same way in my previous, you know, life chapter. It was more like organic. It happened very naturally and one thing led to another. And I was, the only thing I felt I did was like going, you know, surfing the wave. Like I went, I didn't stop anything or I didn't think too much.
What was it like growing up in your family? Was gender equality or activism a part of your background? And how were women valued specifically in your home?
I've been looking back at my background recently because honestly, this I really have something with women and, you know, gender equality. And I sometimes question myself and I'm like, but where does that come from? Because it feels sometimes it feels that it arises from your immediate experience. For example, for me, my experience in Brazil. And so you have a rational reasoning about it. And you're like, yeah, of course, this experience led to this. But actually, when you have very strong commitment, usually it comes from much, much, you know, deeper layers of yourself. I mean, it's just experience that makes things arise. But I think, at least in my case, it comes from deeper layers and my background. Growing up in my family, I come from, let's say, a privileged background. My parents come from two very different worlds. My father comes from a traditional family, so women don't work. Women, you know, their kingdom is their house. So, for example, my grandmother, my aunts, so my father's sisters, they are all perfect housewives, but it's like an art. It's an art. It's like you come into their place and it's like, it's beautiful and they have great taste and it's really an art. So basically they put their creativity and everything they don't put outside in the world, they put in their home, you know? So it's really like a traditional model, let's say. But that being said, that grandmother, so my father's mother, had a huge impact on me because she was not such a monolithic figure. She was a pianist and she was very much into arts and she opened me to the outside world, which is very paradoxical because she didn't raise her daughter like that. So she shaped really who I was in a very strong way, much more than my grandfather. So, and on my mother's side, they come from Aveyron, for the one who listening who know where Aveyron is, which is in the very center of France. It's like what we call a diagonal du vide. So it's like nothing happening there. It's like pure deep countryside, but very strong women there. Very, very strong women there. It's really paradoxical too, because I've been raised by a mother who has a discourse that is really strong. So basically, she always told me, be independent, work. All the women in my family always worked. If you look into the details, it was not that simple. It's super patriarchal structure in the family. And basically, my mother, even though she was telling me all those things, she was in a very traditional, you know, she was in with my father. I mean, he was a bread maker. And what I learned from that, and I try to remind, to remember when I look at my daughter now, is that you really raise children by example. You know, I think because children, you can tell them be independent and work, and women must be. If you yourself are in a schema, in an organization where actually you're more dependent on your husband, which was my mother's case up to a certain point, the true message that you're passing on is this one. And so after that, my parents split. I experienced for my mother what it means to become suddenly a single mother and to not have, I was 13. And I saw what it means for a woman to, you know, financially depend really on someone. So my father was always present financially. He was not present physically, but financially he never let us down. But I could understand at that point what it means for a woman, you know, who didn't basically prepare for anything like that, to suddenly become really, and to see your life, you know, your living condition drop. So you have, it's not that easy, you know. It's strong women, but on the other hand, not that strong. And on my father's side, it was the contrary. You could feel, you could, if you look very quickly, you could have the feeling that those women were only housewives, but actually they had found a way to exert their power in a very, very, strong way. And also, now I think about it, talking to you, I realized that I actually took a lot of example on my family's men too.
Mm.
Actually, at some point, I think I stopped identifying only to women. Everybody said that I walk like the men in my family, for example, the way I walk, the way I move, etc. So I think, yeah, definitely the question of womanhood and equality of gender has been in my life forever.
So interesting.
Yeah.
It's interesting what you also say about, you know, you can have a certain kind of discourse that you want to pass forward and that you want to transmit. What we're going to grasp onto is the actions that are around us, the behavior.
Mm-hmm.
And so I just find that super interesting that maybe there were behaviors on your father's side that were empowered behaviors, even though their role was staying at home, but that maybe you interpreted that as like an expression of creative empowerment or independence.
Mm-hmm.
And just like, it's not as cookie cutter as we might want it to be in order to simplify things. And mm-hmm. that you then adopted some of, you know, the masculine traits, you know, in quotes, from maybe the men who you wanted to be like, because you thought that maybe they had something, they were going out in the world and achieving something that was something similar to what you wanted to do.
Exactly. And that's something I think interesting is how come I didn't feel any barriers, me being a girl, you know? And that's something I think really shaped my commitment later in life for gender equality at work, is that my entire life before starting working, I had not felt at all that being a girl and then being a young, you know, an adolescent or anyways, being a girl would shape my life or limit my life in any way.
Mm.
And that's something that quite mysterious. I don't know how that thing, that conviction was passed on to me. I don't know if it's my father, my mother, I couldn't, but really I grew up with that. Entering the work life has been a shock in that perspective, because for the first time I realized that, yes, it did matter. Then the shock gave birth to the commitment that I have today. Yeah.
Right. One of the things you talk about in your book, which I'm dying to know more about, is you talk about how you use caricature as a way to exaggerate the disconnect between the way you were being treated and the way that your male peers were being treated in your environment. And I know that you have a very strong art appreciation and background. And so I just wanted you to give a little bit more information about how you use caricature as a way to help you really see the contrast and accept the reality for what it was.
Well, it was more like the situation I was put in that helped me, because being the only woman, like being in minority is one thing. Being the only woman is totally something else. And I think I had not anticipated the consequences of being the only woman everywhere I went in the workplace. It really helped me, because everything related to the difference between a girl and a boy or a man or a woman appeared in such a clear way that it made me gain a lot of time, because I always thought that if I had started working even in the same field, but let's say in Europe, for example, or in the US, where maybe I would have been in minority as a woman, but not the only one, I probably would have experienced exactly the same things. But the biases and the would have been made much less clear to analyze and understand. And so it made my life so much easier, because I could say, okay, this definitely has to do with me being a woman. So my first year as a trader was like a succession of examples of that. And I really had to learn very quickly how to navigate this environment and find solutions, because I really loved my job. You know, I really fought to get there. I really went for it. Like I crossed the ocean and I said, okay, I want to become a commodity trader. And it didn't happen like that either. So I really fought for it. And once I was there, I wanted to stay there and thrive there. So I had to understand how it worked, how this male environment worked, and how I could make my own place in that world without betraying who I was.
Yeah, what's the example that you feel was the light bulb moment for you?
One I could say, because there are so many, is at the very, very beginning of my experience. So we had been working as traders like for, I don't know, less than 6 months. It was the very beginning. And what's funny is that I've been hired with another junior trader, like the same day. So we were both, so it was very easy to compare, right? Because we were both the same age, zero experience, you know. It was really like two blank pages learning at the same time. And so on one of those days, basically we were given a mission, both of us together. And at the end of the day, our boss comes to us and asks how the day went, because it was like the very first important mission that was given to us. And then something happened that was really a detail, but that changed everything, that my colleague stood up and told my boss how the day went, but very faithfully, like we both, and he said, we worked together, we did this, we did that, we made that much money, et cetera, et cetera. But the fact that he stood up and I did not made him the leader of the day in my boss's eyes. And so the answer of my boss has been, great job. His name was Juan. Great, great job, Juan. You did great today. Carry on like that. And without
you're like, and me.
Yeah. But I didn't say anything. I didn't say anything. Why didn't I say anything? Today I can talk about that. But at the moment, it was just, you know, me being completely passive and thinking that because my colleague had done the job of talking for us both, we would both be recognized for that work. And that was a very big mistake.
What do you think, if you now trace yourself back to that moment, what prevented you from standing up first?
I don't know. It was maybe a lack of habit, you know, to stand up, you know, in every sense of the word, like to a lack of habit to having to promote what I did. It was completely new for me. And maybe the feeling that I was not allowed to do that, a lack of habit of prendre la parole. Prendre la parole is like prendre, take the right to speak up without being allowed to do it. That was new.
Right. Was instead of someone to be like, so Clara, what do you have to say?
Exactly.
How was your day?
Absolutely. I was expecting that. I was waiting for my boss to turn to me and say, and you, Clara, tell me your version of the story. It's been like a real lesson for me. Like, you need to take the space. You need to speak up. It's very radical, if you think about it, to take the space without being allowed to do it. Like, to take your right to exist in every sense of the word, physically. Like, my colleague, he stood up. And you have so many occasions at work too, where you have to say something without being, you know, given formally the authorization to speak it. And it's extremely difficult to do. And especially when you've been your whole life shaped in a way that just, you know, makes you think that you're allowed to talk when you're given permission to talk and given the permission to express your opinion when you're asked. And all of this, you have to make it explode and invent something else at work, because otherwise you're going to be stuck forever. And so my work ever since has been, okay, how can I carry this message in a way that other people can experience it in themselves, you know, almost physically, that urge to exist without being allowed to exist. How can I transmit, you know, that idea that nobody ever is going to give them the authorization to, okay, it can happen, obviously, but it doesn't happen every time. And how do I pass on the idea that they have all right to do so?
Right. Well, there's something that I like, the word keeps coming to me is permission.
Yeah.
And they're one of the themes that I hear all the time in the work that I do is there's a certain kind of expected behavior that, especially in France, has to do with very strong divisions of power, especially in the education system. And, you know, the l'enfant has to be well-behaved, sage, you know, doesn't speak out, don't do anything that is out of the ordinary, you know, only answer when called on. But I think that if we want to, make a caricature out of it, it's much more debilitating for women who also have that carried on into their personal lives too, or expectations within their family. This idea that you have to be well-behaved, docile, and be part of a system that takes care of other people too. And there is a lot of strong beliefs out there about what is permitted behavior and what is unacceptable behavior. And sometimes I hear often that there's something egotistical and arrogant and selfish when you stand up and speak out and call attention to yourself without being asked to do so. Mm. How do you feel that you being raised in France, you may have been susceptible to that? And this also, like, this bon élève syndrome.
Yeah.
What was it like for you to realize that mindset and that way of behaving wasn't going to get you where you wanted to go, but maybe it had at different parts of your journey? And what did it feel like to let go of that when you've been raised with that being a real truth?
Yeah. You know, hearing you, I think it could be great to do an episode about comparing the American school system and the French school system, because you must have, you know, you have the comparison. I don't. And I would love to understand how, you know, American children are raised and maybe made, you know, that turns them into freer adults. For sure, being a French woman, every time I assert myself, because that's what we're talking about, right? Saying, I want this. I have this desire to get there. I have this ambition, or I disagree, or I agree. It's like really asserting yourself as an individual and a person without putting the other one's expectations first or the group's interests before your own. That's very transgressive. Mm-hmm. That's very transgressive every time you do it. And actually, I think even though today I feel much entitled to do it, and it's much more comfortable for me to do it, I have to fight for it every day, because I live with this discomfort every day. That's something I try to pass on to the women I talk to, it that there is nothing comfortable about everything we're talking about. Like the moment you decide to franchir le Rubicon and go from a position where you're passive and you wait for other people's approval and, you know, a permission, and you take it, there is no going back. That's a great radical act of freeing yourself from all those expectations and everything that you were, you know, morphed into during your child years, and et cetera, et cetera. But still, once you're on the other side of the Rubicon, it's really uncomfortable. Because you expose yourself every time to other people's judgment. You take the risk of being, you know, judged or rejected, or, you know, or maybe sacked in some cases. It happens. Like a woman, you know, there was this great debate about, oh, but where does it come from, the difference of salary between men and women? And you have people saying, well, women don't ask. And then you had other people saying, well, they do ask, but when they do, they don't get what they ask for. And actually, both are right. Because I think we know at maybe a subconscious level that there is a risk in asking, in asserting yourself in that way. There is a risk there. Some people decide to take it, and some people say, you know what, I don't want to go there because the risk is too high. And what I try to pass on as a message is, obviously the greatest risk of all is to not go at all, because then you frustrate yourself and you never give your full potential. You never give your chance the chance to really express yourself at work. And for me, that's the greatest risk of all. Mm. For me, obviously, and that was a great, you know, shock when I started working, I thought I was free. I thought I was, you know, free to be whoever I wanted to be. And I was not at all. I was like everybody else. I was the good student by excellence, you know, who only spoke when she was asked something, who didn't say what she thought, who only stick to what she was asked to do without going, you know, looking outside the box or outside the lines, who actually concentrated her focus and energy on the satisfaction of other people, or like the hierarchy, etc., instead of looking at her work environment and saying, okay, what can I get from here before moving on to my next step? And that's actually a whole re-education of myself that I had to do.
Well, it reminds me of what you say about the micro empowerments.
Yeah.
There are a couple of things that are connecting back. Is it's such a complex systemic web of inequality and disempowerment that, you know, it's generational, it's societal, it's systemic, it's intentional, it's intrinsic. It's so complicated, but you just cut right through and you're like, we don't have time to answer the question, why is this happening?
Yes.
We need to find how can we deal with it right this fucking second.
Yeah.
And I love it. It's like, okay, yes, we can get very philosophical, but I think that this is something that's intrinsic to who you are. Like, you look for actionable tools.
Mm-hmm.
Once you've analyzed the situation enough,
mm-hmm.
you look for concrete tools that are going to move the needle forward and, you know, get you to that next incremental place. And so I love the idea of micro empowerments. I'm a big fan of Atomic Habits and the idea of just like, what small thing can you do right now that is going to make you feel empowered? Instead of spending our time working only on the why is this happening, it's what are the small shifts that you can make right now that are going to make you feel like you're taking charge of your future, you're standing up for yourself. So how did you come up with that? And how did that shift things for you?
Well, I came to that through my own experience, because, you know, when I started to realize, okay, there is something there, like being a woman really is not, in my case, an asset at work. I'm carrying too many things inside of me that, you know, inhibit me. So I try to look for answers and solutions. So I tried, you know, I started reading books and watching videos, and that was good to do that. You know, it made me realize that, okay, I was not the only one, and I was part of a, as you said, really systemic problem. But still, the problem with all that was that my own reality, when the next day I was going back to my desk, to my office, and, you know, having to deal with my colleagues and boss and phone calls, and my reality didn't change. And I was like, okay, now we need to change the scale. And so micro empowerment simply means, okay, let's change the scale. And what I came to realize is actually a professional life is not made of big achievements and big turning points. It's actually made of teeny, tiny steps every single day, one after the other. It's that informal conversation that you have with that nice people that is going to open your mind and lead you to apply to that other job. The idea that you express in a meeting that is going to make that other person think of you for that new project. Actually, it's a part of it that I think is so much more interesting, is to look into what is actually actionable for each and every one of us every single day. And as you said, it's super empowering, because everybody, and it doesn't have to do with personality, being an extrovert or being at ease with hierarchy or whatever, or with money, every single one of us can actually put those little steps into place. So to make your work visible, to promote what you're doing, to be identified for your achievements, to negotiate what you want, to ask for what you want, to be political, all those awful words that nobody loves, nobody likes, and me the first. Mm-hmm. Actually, when you look into the details of what they mean, you come to realize that, oh, actually, that I can do, and that I can do. And actually doing that, you realize that your territory of initiatives and freedom at work is much, much bigger than you thought. So that's the first conclusion. I would have, you know, saved a lot of time if I had been said all this at the beginning of my professional life. But all these little steps that allowed you to maximize what you can maximize today without considering the background, cultural, historical, sociological, that we all carry. And I'm not, you know, saying that those things are not interesting. It's super interesting. But I came to realize, and how did I come to realize that? It's because after years hearing about good student, enfin, bon élève, le syndrome de la bonne élève, good student syndrome, imposter syndrome, I was like, but wait, those syndromes, for example, the imposter syndromes, it has been identified and named for the first time in the US in the 70s. So it's over 40 years old. It's so famous today that many women manage to actually identify when they are a victim of the syndrome live in their everyday life. Like they manage to say, oh, wait, this is my imposter syndrome talking for me or acting for me. And yet, it's very difficult to get rid of it. And at that point, when I realized that, I was like, okay, there is an issue there. Because usually when you name something and you identify that thing, you manage, it's the first step to get rid of it, right? But in those cases, it's very specific to, you know, inhibition at work. You manage to see it. You know where they stand and where they express themselves, but still you cannot rid of it. And I think it has to do with what we were saying before about transgression and how difficult it is to do it. But that's also why I said, okay, you know what? We're going to have to live with it. You don't have to get to the root of everything. Because it's going to take so long, and my life is happening today. My right. professional life is not in 80 years; it's today. So that's where I shifted.
Well, it kind of loops back to what we were saying in the beginning of the conversation about when things feel very opaque and confusing, and you're in the fog, and you're just waiting for the big clearing to occur in order for you to make the steps. But it's about these small shifts. It's about what can you do right now, despite things feeling very claustrophobic or terrifying or unjust. What are the small things that you can do? And I find that it can be applied to everything, everything, every relationship, every dynamic has that potential to shift with something very small, because we're part of these systems. And so once you make a small shift, maybe so-and-so is going to react a little bit differently. But like, that was unexpected. Like, I didn't. Okay, now I'm all discombobulated. It's those patterns that are so set that become so rigid because there's just an expectation that everyone's going to fall in place. And women specifically being the ones who usually just play it by the rules. So I'm interested now. I also had this like funny little connecting dot. I was like, wait a second. It's all about values, market, anticipation. And I was like, how did she go from analyzing crops and the value of crops to basically analyzing, projecting women's value in the marketplace? So am I crazy? Is there a connection? And because now I'd love for you to talk a little bit about more like concretely, what are you doing about helping women feel more empowered financially? How is that connected back to all of this?
Yeah, I don't know, actually. I would need to think about it. It's an interesting connection. I'm super interested in how, in the relationship between women and money. I think you could link it to my background too, somehow, because... because money has been, I don't know, it has never been a taboo. And for some reason, maybe that's because I also at some point started identifying with my family's men. I realized that I was comfortable with money and I was good with money. I was, you know, I take good decisions and I'm at ease with it. Alors, I think that's not the first thing that drove me to trading in the first place. Even though obviously it's a world where you talk about money all day. And then women and money. So I started working on that topic about 2 years ago. How come that money to women today make money, save money, but do not invest their money. When you think about it, it's exactly the same thing that we were talking about before in the workplace, is how do you exist in the world? When you think about what it means to for women in history to conquer their rights, it has always been about conquering the outer space, outside of the home, right? Physically, politically, economically. So having the right to vote, having the right to work, having the right to drive, having the right to open a bank account without the husband, the father, blah, blah, blah. It's always about putting yourself physically outside of your home, and investing your money is the extension of that. It is how do you exist in the world with the money that you make. Because investing your money, it's not about, oh, I want to make more money with my money and build the patrimoine for my family, etc. It is like this. It can be like this. Fine. But when you make an investment decision, you actually decide where your money goes. Okay, I want to finance this. I want to finance this kind of company, this kind of field, etc., etc. And especially in the world we live in, it's a very, very political and radical decision for someone to say, I want to finance this kind of industry and not that one. So you shape the world in the way you want. So it's really, and for me, and obviously we could talk about that for hours, but obviously women and money, it's like the ultimate taboo. A woman who talks freely about money, she's not really well accepted. First, in our societies, it is considered or vulgaire. There is something in France with money. Aristocrats in history, they never worked, obviously, and they never talk about money because it means that you don't have it. If you have it, you don't need to talk about it. And so there is this whole historical, you know, heritage about the one who talks about money openly, or he has recent money, which is called nouveau riche, which is almost an insult in France, or he doesn't have it. He has money issues. So it's something about the shame, right? So you have this taboo that has many, many roots, actually. It's really complex. But for women, it's even more taboo because, first of all, we have been, you know, obviously controlled and said to stay in the home. Money by excellence is the thing that happens outside the home. Then we have been, you know, told to take care of others. You know, investing your money is like the ultimate individual, you know, centered decision that you can make. It's my money, my decision, etc. Even though you want to finance your children's study or whatever, it's really. And so I think there is something there to unlock as well. And there is a lack of education, obviously. I mean, it's so recent. The story in front of money and women and money, it's the 60s that we have the right to open a bank account, to work for ourselves. And it's extremely recent, so we don't have a lot of background. And if you look what happens into families, it's still very much a man's business, you know, even to administrate people money. Mm-hmm. So it's something that passes on from father to son, or sometimes the father administrates himself his daughter's money, but it doesn't mean that he teaches them anything. Of course, it's changing, but it's very slow. And I mean, it's really a whole education and a whole relation to risk and a whole relation to how do I exist in the world that you need to reframe. And I love that topic. Women and money, I think it's really the last frontier. Even though we started talking about it more and more, there are great initiatives, you know, media, young media that vulgarize very well the topic, etc. Many things that exist that are great. I mean, the big scale work is still huge and in front of us.
Yeah. And also, I think it's interesting what you say about the taboo part. The taboo, yeah. And it connects back to, you know, women standing up, winning, taking, you know, asserting themselves, which is not something that is, you know, well regarded. There's something transgressive, taboo, and, you know, there's something sexy about it, Clara.
Yeah, there is. No, but there is. Absolutely. I think that's why it makes people not so a bit uneasy. You know, a woman who comes there and talks about money, there's something un peu impudique about it. You know, there is something. I think you're absolutely right. It has to do a little bit with, because it's so manly in our subconscious. It's something that really, and even with men, you can see, like, it's a way of measuring yourself. And you, I mean, if I,
it's that's power, again, it's status, it's power, influence, status, freedom, the freedom to get the hell out if you don't want to stay where you are. And that's something I think it's just a fascinating whole new dimension that in the conversation around women's empowerment needs to be reinforced and democratized and really like kind of a first base to understand what is a woman's financial freedom, you know, projected trajectory look like, because that is going to have an impact on how risky a person can be when they're in the workplace and asking for things, and also how she shows up in her family and her relationship. And so I totally see a a connection between, you know, the rules of the game and you coming to this space. It's really exciting.
But you're absolutely right. It's all linked in about freedom. And something that is super important to remind is that you don't have to have a lot of money. When we talk about money, it's not about having a lot of money to start getting interested into one's money. You can start very, very low. You can start with your first, you know, salaries and save 20 euros per month, 50 euros per month. We're not talking big money here. Mm-hmm. It's just the fact that you embrace the question of your money. What do you want to do with it? Because if you want to make a symbolic parallel, why do women are so good at saving and so bad at investing? It's so obvious, right? Because saving, it stays, it's really the feminine way, right? It stays home, basically. Investing go out of the home. It's much more, you know, that's what we were talking. And so obviously we've been trained for centuries to stay, you know, inside, and just you have this gap, and the men, they have been trying to expand,
right?
And that's exactly so great. The movement we need to learn.
So what are you doing about it? Are you teaching this? Are you coaching people? Are you writing about this? What are you doing?
I'm not coaching people. I wrote a second podcast about it, which has not been translated to English yet, unfortunately, called Le Starter Pack. And the objective is really to reconcile women with the idea of investment. You know, it's not even, I'm not allowed anyways to give advice or anything. You have to be a professional to do that. But it's the idea, okay, what are we talking about? You know, to de-dramatize a little bit the subject, and people, because the anxiety about investment comes from, okay, I don't know anything about it. I'm going to be, you know, people are going to sell me their shit, basically, and I won't be able to know if it's good or if it's bad, and I don't want this, and I'm afraid, I don't have time, blah, blah, blah. Donc, first step, you know, breathe and just get into the subject in a very easy way, and reconcile and understand it's really, really not that complicated. That's the first thing. And then, I do basically the same thing I've been doing with the rules of the game, which is I talk about it. I talk about it everywhere. So companies, I started teaching at schools. So my tool is my words.
So great. So I want to just kind of close the circle here a little bit and just find out from you, based on everything we've discussed so far, what have you learned about your journey and the woman that you're becoming more of?
I think I have learned to listen more. That's paradoxical because I just said I talk all the time, but to think that things can happen in many different ways and not only one way. There is not only one way for things to happen, and to listen more to people and to what comes at you. You know, I think for a very long time, for many reasons, and I was very, you know, hard on the way things should be, and, you know, very, very concentrated on my objective. And I think I became more soft. Maybe that's because I'm leaving a bigger part to my feminine side, which before I was more, you know, in a warrior attitude towards life. because I needed it before as well. And now I think the more time passes by and the more open I am to life in general, which doesn't mean everything is easy every day, but I think the biggest change in me over the past few years has been that.
That's so interesting that it's about kind of reconciling.
Yeah.
The different.
Yeah. Maybe leaving more space to the feminine in me. Yeah.
How interesting. I love this conversation so much, and I'm going to make sure that everyone can find you in the show notes. And thank you so much for all the amazing work you're doing.
Thank you so much. And it was great talking to you. It had been such a long time. I'm happy we got the chance to chat a little bit.
Me too. Well, we can go on and on and on.
Yeah.
But thank you so much, Clara, for joining me today.
Thank you, Ziva. It was great. I love your podcast. I listen to every episode. Never told you that. I love it.
Thank you so much, sweetie. Well, I'll see you soon.
See you soon.
I am so appreciative of having your time and your attention, and would love to hear anything you have to say, any feedback, any questions, any requests. You can leave me a voice message if you go to speakpipe.com/onbecoming. That's speakpipe, speakpipe.com/onbecoming. I promise to get back to you. If this podcast has touched you, inspired you, transformed you in any way, it would mean the world to me if you would leave a 5-star review on your favorite podcast listening platform.